It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Tuesday of this week, a 23-year-old Des Moines man was shot in his head in northwest Des Moines. He died the next day on Wednesday of this week. The name of the shooting victim, Choice Elliston. His murder is one of an unusually high number of homicides in Des Moines this year. Also, an increased number of shootings. Shooting violence in general is up in the area. Charlie Haley is with us, a breaking news reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Charlie. You've been covering this.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
Tell us about this specific shooting. What do we know about it? Happened Tuesday afternoon. What can you tell us about it?
Right. Well, around 2 o'clock on Tuesday, police were receiving some 911 calls about people hearing gunshots in the area of 30th Street and Hickman Road. And shortly after, they got a call from Brelbons Medical Center that someone had brought a gunshot victim there. And I think, you know, they were able to pretty quickly put together that he was the victim from these calls they were receiving from 30th and Hickman. Unfortunately, he later died the next morning.
Also, later than the day, there were other shootings reported, and I don't know if they could ascertain whether these were connected. One at 6:30 in the evening, one at 9:30 in the evening. What do we know about those? Any connection or other sort of random shooting violence?
Right. The police said that it is too early to say whether those other two shootings are connected to the homicide. In those other two, one man was shot in each incident, but they are both expected to survive or have survived. But police said it is too early to tell whether that is connected to the homicide.
The man who died on Wednesday, who was shot on Tuesday, Choice Elliston, marks the 14th homicide in Des Moines this year. How does that compare with previous years in Des Moines?
Right. That is a very unusually high number of homicides so far in the year. And I guess I should add that the three shootings on Tuesday, that's a really unusually high number of shootings to have in one night. But last year, for the entire year, there was 13 homicides, which I think was a little bit more typical for an entire year. But to have 14 already just in May is very unusual.
Yeah, so 14 in May. There were 13 total homicides in all of 2016. Has people alerted here, I'm sure law enforcement in Des Moines, any reasons that the police are giving for the spike in homicides?
Right. I think it's difficult to explain why this would happen. I think that most people who hear this are surprised, but one thing that police have said is that they are responding to more calls of, like, gunshots fired, and in those cases, not necessarily someone is hurt, but just that someone may hear gunshots or that something may be damaged. And they are also saying that they are confiscating more guns off the street. In these cases, it's, you know, people who aren't licensed to have that firearm, maybe, or it may be a stolen weapon. So that could potentially be contributing.
Mm-hmm. Also, as you bring out in your reporting, Charlie, that a couple times late last year in 2016, people who happened to be in the vicinity when a shooting broke out were actually killed, right?
Right, yeah. In September 2016, a 61-year-old woman was, police said she was struck by a stray bullet as she was waiting in the parking lot of a Family Dollar. And then less than 2 months later, a 14-year-old kid was shot in his head. Police say it was also a stray gunshot, that he did not do anything to provoke that shooting. But in both cases, the victims died, unfortunately. But police say that kind of random killing is not necessarily the norm as far as just bystanders being hit by a stray bullet.
So cases where people are just happen to be in the vicinity and are killed by stray bullets, that hasn't happened that much?
Right. I mean, clearly it has happened, but the police have described to us that the majority of cases they consider to be relationship-based as far as the suspect and victim know each other.
Okay. Charlie Haley, Des Moines Register breaking news reporter, talking about the uptick in homicides, shooting violence in Des Moines, where the police department says that combating violent crime is their number one priority at the moment. Thanks for the update, Charlie.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, Iowa's first congressional district representative, Congressman Rod Blum, has held four town halls this week here in Iowa with a lot of moments of, I guess you'd say, raucous energy from the constituents attending. On Monday, he was in Dubuque, on Tuesday in Cedar Rapids, Wednesday in Cedar Falls, finished up the week yesterday, Thursday, in Marshalltown. Well, he got booed at some of the events while he defended his vote on the Republicans' health care, the repeal of Obamacare. Katerina Sestarek is with us of Iowa Public Radio. Katerina, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you were at one of the town hall meetings. Which one?
I was at the Cedar Rapids town hall on Tuesday.
Okay, tell us about the atmosphere you found there.
Well, it was very loud. There were a lot of people shouting down everything that the congressman said, essentially. They were booing. They were jeering. They were interrupting. It was pretty wild.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the themes behind the questions, the shouted questions, the comments from the constituents?
Healthcare was a huge theme. People were not happy with the congressman's vote to pass the American Healthcare Act, which is the approximate repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. They weren't happy with that at all. Some other themes were Russia and Russia's possible ties to the Trump administration, as well as things like Planned Parenthood and climate change were also very controversial.
Mm-hmm. What has been a hallmark of not only town halls here in Iowa, these town halls, but across the country have been people coming in with red and green cards. Explain sort of the significance and how these are used and have been used by constituents in these town hall meetings.
Sure. Well, people are bringing in these red and green sheets of paper, especially for Blum's town halls. Signs weren't allowed, so people wanted to use these red and green sheets of paper to show either their disapproval or approval for what the congressman was saying. And they were meant to maybe make the town halls not so loud, but people were also vocally expressing their approval or disapproval. So there was a lot of waving of red sheets of paper throughout the event.
And it's interesting that in past town halls, not necessarily with Congressman Blum, but with others that we've talked about, there have been charges that people have been bussed in from other districts, other parts of Iowa, or even other parts of the Midwest as well. But Congressman Blum screens the people coming into these town halls?
Right. So for these town halls, in order to get in, people first had to RSVP ahead of time, and then they had to show photo ID proving that they live in his congressional district. So he said that he didn't want people from Minneapolis and Chicago coming in and causing trouble. Well, these were definitely all people from his own district.
Mm-hmm. So how did Congressman Blum handle the raucous crowds?
He just paused his sentences a lot. He would get a few words out and people would interrupt him very loudly. He would just stop talking, wait for it to die down, and then continue on. That was pretty much what happened throughout the night.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to play a piece of tape, and perhaps you can give us some context for this. This is an interview that Representative Blum did with KCRG-TV this week. Just 2 minutes into the taping is what we're going to hear the sound from. Reporter Josh Scheinblum of KCRG-TV was asking about Blum's decision to ban Iowans who live outside of Blum's district from attending his town hall event. That was to happen later that day. Well, it starts off the audio here with reporter Josh Scheinblum, and then you'll hear as Congressman Blum gets up and interrupts the interview after only a couple minutes. See what you think of this.
Well, I think some would make the case that you represent all Iowans. The decisions that you make impact all Iowans. So shouldn't all Iowans have a voice at the table, or at least have the option to?
I don't represent all Iowans. I represent the first district of Iowa. That'd be like saying, shouldn't I be able to, even though I live in Dubuque, go vote in Iowa City during the election? Because I'd like to vote in that district instead.
Would you still take donations from a Republican in Iowa City?
This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous.
He's going to sit here and just badger
right,
me.
All right.
We just asked why you wanted to do the interview. That was it. Congressman, take a seat. Congressman, I insist. Let's talk about...
Take donations from...
Okay, there you have it, KCRG-TV reporter Josh Shine Bloom, talking with U.S. Congressman Rod Blum. Very short interview, lasting, well, less than 5 minutes, I would guess, there. What do you make of that, Katarina, there?
Well, that interview or partial interview happened just a few hours before his first town hall in Dubuque on Monday. And some people brought that up at the town hall. And I think it really just added fuel to the fire of what was already shaping up to be a loud and controversial event.
And it certainly made some national news when a politician, a U.S. congressman, walks out of an interview. At this town hall meeting, you said you were at the one of the four, Cedar Rapids, on Wednesday. Also defenders of Congressman Blum there as well?
There were definitely moments when you could hear a mixture of cheering and booing when he made some statements. For example, when he talked about Planned Parenthood, and Congressman Blum said that he's pro-life, and you could definitely hear there were some people who were supporting that and some people opposing that. So some things like that were apparent.
And Katarina, on the healthcare issue, which has stuck out in the town hall meetings here a lot, constituents. These are constituents personally affected by possible changes in the Affordable Care Act?
Right. People were talking about their experiences with Medicaid, with being on the individual exchange, and they were not happy with Blum's assessment that they wouldn't be affected by the bill. He was saying that people, you know, with employer health insurance and things like that would absolutely not be affected. But there are indications that people could be affected, and a lot of constituents brought that up and pushed back on those claims.
Okay. Katarina Sestarek of Iowa Public Radio telling us about one of several town halls attended by U.S. Congressman Rod Blum in Iowa. Thank you, Katarina.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, perhaps you wear a Fitbit or a similar device that tracks your physical activity. Imagine a pig wearing a Fitbit. Yes, a swine wearing one of those devices. Why on earth would you do that? Well, it seems far-fetched, but two University of Iowa students founded SwineTech and have this invention that is essentially a Fitbit for pigs. And in doing so, they won a $10,000 prize from the Lemelson MIT Student Prize Program. Joining us to talk about the prize-winning pig Fitbit is Matthew Rhoda of SwineTech. He is the CEO and the inventor of this little device. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So what is this device called?
So this device is called SmartGuard, and what it does is operates in three stages. It, first of all, will regulate temperatures in all of the pens to ensure that we can reduce disease and starvation of the little piglets. Second, it'll identify with audio processing technology when a mother is crushing her baby and then alerts her to stand up with vibrational impulses. And then third, we track all of their health so we can give farmers everything they need to not only improve the health of the pigs, but also plan ahead.
Okay, so this is not measuring steps or calories burned by the pig. This is measuring other things that are important for the swine producer.
Oh, for sure. It's much more than just a health tracking device for pigs.
Mm-hmm. How does it do that? You mentioned preventing mothers from rolling over on their piglets. This happens? This is a problem?
Yeah, it's a very big problem. It's actually the biggest problem in the pork industry for the last 40 years. Last year alone, 116 million piglets died from this, and it resulted in just over 30 billion pounds of pork that went to waste. And in today's world, that could go a long ways.
So this device listens for the piglet in distress?
Yes, just like a baby monitor would listen to the cries of a little infant in a crib.
And then how does it tell the mother, hey, roll back over, don't do that?
Yeah, so that Fitbit patch that we have placed on the sow, the wearable, has a vibrator inside that's placed on sensitive areas where it just annoys the mom, gets her to move and stand up.
Sensitive areas?
Yeah, like the ear or on the belly, just where it tickles.
Oh, okay. So, and you've tested this out. It works.
Yeah, we tested on a few operations, and so far I've seen about a 74% success rate in saving that little baby piglet, and are excited about where we're about to go in the future.
Mm-hmm. So what does the device look like?
So the device looks a lot like just a baby monitor, something that slides right on the side of the pig pen that will sit there and listen, will monitor the heat lamps. But the wearable patch actually looks a lot like a medication patch that you would put on somebody's back in a hospital or a nursing home. It's just a medical adhesive that 3M makes that we're able to place on the pig.
Interesting. And so how much have you tested this product?
So we tested it over the last year in and out of operations. Right now we're currently in manufacturing, so everything to date has been done with 3D-produced products. So with that comes a lack of durability and and results in shorter trial test periods. But we're about to enter some really large operations with some longer series trials and about to do some university trials and are ready to launch this around the world.
Mm-hmm. How did you are the inventor of the Smart Guard, this sort of Fitbit for pigs. How did you come up with this idea? Was there a eureka moment?
There actually was a huge eureka moment. So I was actually in my freshman and sophomore year managing large sow farm in Waterloo, Iowa. I had talked to the acceptance committee for med school, actually, at the University of Iowa, and was advised that if I could set myself apart from my peers, it'd help me a lot in getting accepted into med school. I asked them, so if I work on a farm, deal with sedatives, all the medications to help deliver babies, would that give me a better chance of getting accepted so I could be an obstetrician someday? And they loved it. So I got a management position, was doing the job, showed up one morning, and found that 8 piglets had been crushed by one mom. And this was an ongoing problem, but never had it been that big. And that's when it really just sank in that I needed to find a way to solve this problem. And on the farm, we could always teach the pigs to do certain things, whether that was going to a certain pen to eat or how would you move throughout the facilities. And I just figured there's got to be a way to teach mother pigs not to crush their babies. And it just so happened that there was.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What have been the challenges in developing this device, the Smart Guard?
A lot of challenges. The wearable itself is a huge challenge. We went through many different concepts. Just keeping something on a pig and something that's durable is not easy. They're very destructive animals. And the next biggest thing that we had was differentiating where that squeal was coming from. These rooms have hundreds of little pigs, and you got to be able to pinpoint where that squeal is coming from. And it took hours and hours and hours of coding just to figure that out.
Now, for this invention, Matthew, you won a $10,000 prize from the Lemelson MIT Student Prize Program. Congratulations, by the way.
Hey, thank you.
What will that $10,000 go for, if I may ask?
Yeah, so that $10,000 is going to help us a lot with manufacturing and just getting the wearable devices sourced out from textile manufacturing companies so that we could go out and run the trials we need to really grow. We also just got back from Europe and received the Global Student Innovation of the Year Award in Frankfurt. And just having the opportunities as a student entrepreneur to partake in things like MIT, like entrepreneurial organizations, GSDA, and other events through like Microsoft or other companies, it's everything that we need to allow ourselves to have the best opportunity to grow and really survive.
Mm-hmm. Considering this device, this innovation, and the huge market that you're offering this to, I have to believe electronics companies are knocking on your door quite persistently.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of the suppliers are hoping that we go through them, especially manufacturing. We finally found our manufacturer. We're working with a company called Bear Tech out of Cedar Rapids, and they're great. It's really hard to really pinpoint which company is the one you should go through, and making those decisions is a lot of fun, though.
Mm-hmm. How did you evaluate the companies you wanted to work with?
Well, first of all, we wanted to evaluate, can they handle our order quantities that we're going to have to go through? But another important key part for us was we wanted it to be in the U.S. And then finally was we wanted it to be local. There's a level of efficiency that we can go into when it comes to solving problems when it's a local manufacturer. But then there was also that tight-knit network within the community. They know you know they have your back, you have their back, and it can really kind of mitigate risk when it comes to dealing with problems.
Are you looking for investors for this project?
Not anymore. We actually just secured a round of $1.3 million through 15 investors all over the U.S. and just hired on a couple new engineers and are really pushing this thing to get it to market as fast as we can.
Well, I'm picturing this is the launch pad. The engines are revved up, ready to go. This thing is going to go. It's going to launch, and you're going to, do you think, revolutionize livestock production?
I think in the pork industry, we really can. There's a serious lack of automation within the farrowing industry, and farrowing being where the mothers give birth. And there's just a lot of data there that farmers don't have access to that can really change not only the lives of the pigs, but the lives of the farmers. We can help farmers live less stressful lives and also help them just further their communities by them being more successful.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we say goodbye, tell us about the other two functions. We talked a lot about preventing the mothers, that big problem of mothers rolling over on piglets and killing them. The other two dimensions are measuring the health?
Yeah, so one of the dimensions measures the health, and what it can do is really let farmers know exactly when the mom is giving birth. It can let them know how often they're up and down, how often they're eating. And this can really translate into letting feed companies that are trying to formulate individualized feed for pigs know exactly what that mom needs so that she can be as healthy as possible and raise healthy piglets. But it also allows farmers to know which moms might be troublesome mothers the next time around. Is this mom someone that's going to lay on more piglets? Is she going to have more stillbirths? And it's just really giving individuals a better insight to all of their livestock. I mean, we don't have time to go and interview each and every pig to figure out how they're feeling every day, and that's really a problem. And this kind of gives us that opportunity to understand each and every animal and how they interact in their daily life.
Yeah, and to remind our listeners, if their minds aren't already blown by what you're describing here, you are just graduating from the University of Iowa now.
Yeah. Yeah,
so you're a young man just out of the University of Iowa with a business degree, right? Or what is your degree in?
Enterprise leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like business management with an emphasis on leadership.
Mm-hmm. Wow. We'll look for your name, Matthew Rota, on a future Fortune 500 list, I think. You think?
I sure hope so. Pushing for it.
All right. Matthew Rota. CEO of SwineTech and inventor of SmartGuard, sort of a Fitbit for pigs. Thank you, Matthew, and good luck with your production and marketing of this.
Hey, thank you guys very much. You guys have a great day.
Coming up after a short break, political scientist Tim Hagel shares some new research on Iowa voter registration and turnout that may surprise you. Also, Governor Branstad will soon take up residence in Beijing as U.S. ambassador to China. Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register tells us about a crash course on ambassador training. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Monday on this program, we'll listen back to a conversation I had about the teenage brain. So, teenage parents of teenagers, you'll want to tune in on Monday during this time for River to River. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll talk with Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register. He'll join us. He's looked into the crash course that Terry Branstad is taking, our governor, of course, soon taking up residence in Beijing as U.S. ambassador to China. Turns out there's a 3-week crash course for U.S. ambassadors. We'll find out what's involved with that with Kyle Munson in just a moment. But let's talk a little more about politics before we do that. Tim Hagel is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Tim on the phone. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
A big week in politics. Don't have to mention that. We're doing a little bit of extra talking about politics, but do we want to, before we get to the bombshell of the week in terms of politics and the reverberations, let's talk about some research that you've done looking at voter registration and turnout statistics in the state. What did you look at and why?
Well, I found a store of data up on the Iowa Secretary of State's website that goes back, in some cases, all the way to 1982, looking at both voter registration statistics and also results in the elections, gubernatorial and other presidential and other. And I just started playing with it and tried to look at a number of questions in terms of who turns out and looked at the data in terms of party, but also age group and sex, and kind of see, well, which groups turn out more in as midterm elections versus presidential elections and so forth. And it was just kind of interesting to dig into all of that.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find? What surprised you, or did anything surprise you?
Well, a number of things surprised me. A lot of it was confirming conventional wisdom in terms of, you know, that turnout is lower in midterm or gubernatorial elections than they are in presidential elections and so forth. But it was still interesting to see, when you look at those various subgroups, as to which ones turn out more, which ones turn out less. Not surprisingly, the biggest variations are among no-party voters, that they have the biggest swings between the midterm elections and the presidential elections. Another interesting thing, when I sort of did a little bit more estimating in terms of the numbers, to find that in a lot of the elections, one of the things that makes Iowa such a swing state is that quite often it's the no-party voters that determine elections, something I've been saying for a long time. But I saw some numbers that suggested that even sometimes when you have more voters from one party that turn out than another, the distribution of the no-party voters can swing the election to the other candidate. And in fact, that happened 10 out of the 18 times of the gubernatorial and presidential elections from 1982 on.
Mm-hmm. How does that translate into what a campaign strategist would do? How would a campaign strategist use that information that you just went through to improve the chances of his or her candidate?
Well, we know these days that the campaigns are focusing on micro-targeting, that they're doing a lot more with data that they gather over time. And to a certain extent, this helps to either confirm what they already know or to show them, well, what group should they be targeting in terms of who turns out? And that's one of the things, of course, that we want to see the focus on, or I assume that the campaigns want to see a focus on the no-party voters in particular. It's one thing to get your base out, the regular Democratic and Republican voters, but it's, again, potentially the no-party voters that are the ones that maybe are a little less likely overall to turn out. So if you can get them to the polls for your candidate, that there's a good chance that you may be successful in your campaign, even if more voters from the other party turn out.
Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, let's talk a little bit about, the reverberations from the news this week, the sudden firing of FBI Director James Comey by the president. Well, to this morning's news, several remarkable tweets from this morning, the president warning via Twitter, warning FBI Director, the fired FBI Director, about leaking negative information. Also telling the news media he may cancel all future White House briefings. What do you make of the latest tweets this morning as this the shockwaves, reverberations, whatever you want to call them, continue?
Yeah. You know, we had gone through a period when Trump was a candidate of arguing and discussing his tweets and whether they were appropriate and so forth, and that even continued on during the early days of his presidency. And it seemed like for a time that he had sort of come back from that he still was tweeting and sometimes tweeting things that would get a lot of conversation, but they seemed to be calming down to a certain extent. But then today, and in reaction to the Comey firing, or the reaction to the reaction of the Comey firing, I guess, that he is once again sort of stepping out and making these tweets that are getting a lot of conversation, the potential threatening, I guess, if you want to use that word, to Comey to not start leaking information and so forth. And it seems that just generally it's not helpful, and that's probably an understatement, but it's just not helpful in terms of making his case, that there did seem to be some confusion over exactly what the timeline was. I'm not sure how important the timeline and when he determined that he was going to actually fire Comey, whether that's critical as opposed to any other aspect of it. But when you start seeing the president tweeting out things like he did, that it becomes a bit problematic for him to be able to explain the story, so to speak.
Right, and the firing of an FBI director only happening once before under different circumstances in the history of the United States. The FBI has only been around since the 1920s or something like that with the founding by J. Edgar Hoover. But still a remarkable a development here. But also what you just referred to there, his specifically the changing of the story, Lester Holt's interview on NBC with him, and an admission during that interview that Russia, the investigation was on his mind when he fired the FBI director, sort of undercutting not only his words, his story, but the story of the vice president, of his press spokesperson there too. What does that tell you?
Well, again, it's one of these things that we saw during the campaign where the story would change in terms of what exactly the thinking was in terms of leading up to some decision or some comment, something like that. And it's one thing for a candidate to do that, but it's another for the president to do that. And that's one of the things that I think a lot of people on both sides, the president and his administration team, but also the public and the media, are having a hard time sort of reconciling that difference of what we normally expect from politicians, what we expect particularly from office holders and especially the president, versus sort of Trump's view of this and how he's able to handle it. And then, of course, you see, and even right now, his press secretary, Sean Spicer, is giving his press conference, and he has to come out, or whether it was Sarah Huckabee Sanders in the last couple of days, to come out and sort of explain these sorts of things. And sometimes, apparently, they don't have all the information or the current information, or if they haven't talked to the president recently, and so they kind of come out, and it may not entirely be accurate, but then that gives the media an opportunity to say, well, but this isn't what you said yesterday, and so forth. And then, of course, that becomes a point of confusion for the public trying to sort this all out.
Mm-hmm. Let's look a little bit at what the Iowa delegation has been doing. This, of course, Donald Trump's relationship with Congress, now both houses of Congress under control of the GOP in this congressional session there. Iowa's lone Democrat, I can quote him after the firing of Comey. While I've had great disagreements with some of Director Comey's decisions, his firing is an abuse of power and flies in the face of the rule of law. There is no question we must now have an independent investigator handling the Russia investigation. Rod Blum of Iowa's 1st District supporting the firing. David Young, whose district includes Des Moines, that metro area, did not offer his own view of the firing, according to the Des Moines Register, but suggested Comey had, quote, lost the confidence of lawmakers. Steve King, interestingly, perhaps there's an update on this, but according to the Des Moines Register, an aide to Representative Steve King, declining to comment, saying the congressman would be unavailable for the next few days. Interestingly, Senator Grassley issuing a statement saying the handling of the Hillary Clinton email investigation is a clear example of how Comey's decisions have called into question the trust and political independence of the FBI. Senator Grassley, listen to this, Tim. I'm sure you caught this interview with Fox and Friends host Steve Doocy. He asked Senator Grassley a question to which the senator had a very succinct answer.
They're talking about the firing was Nixonian. It has echoes of Watergate with the Saturday Night Massacre, stuff like that. For the people who are writing those headlines, what's your message to them?
My message is suck it up and move on.
Unusually blunt language from Iowa's senior senator, Tim.
Yeah, it's sort of the problem here is that when you're right that we've only seen this sort of firing of an FBI director once before. The circumstances are different. They're always going to be different regardless of what happens, if there's something specific going on. And I think there are legitimate questions you can ask, particularly the basic, well, why now exactly? And I think to a certain extent, it would have been probably just as difficult for Trump to have fired Comey either the first day he took office or any time in between. There's probably never going to be a good time where he wasn't going to get criticized for it. But still, that's still the question as to, well, why did you pick now as opposed to any other time? The problem, though, is for those making asking that question and sort of making some of the arguments is that they did kind of go over the top, comparing it to the reference to the Nixonian, the Saturday Night Massacre, for those that are old enough to remember all of that.
You think that is over the top, or is that yet to be determined, depending on what the investigations find?
Really hasn't found anything at this point.
Yes, we need to have that
information before we can make an accurate determination.
Right, but in the firing of Archibald Cox, a special prosecutor in 1973, it took 10 months after that before it was uncovered and finally led to the downfall of President Nixon. All I'm saying is perhaps we don't know yet, right?
Well, there are the other differences, though, are things that at least at the time where the so-called Saturday Night Massacre took place, where Nixon had to fire his attorney general and then the deputy attorney general, both who refused to fire the special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, and it was Robert Bork that stepped up then and did the firing. So that's the massacre was the two people that had been fired previously. But at that point, we already knew that there were crimes that were committed. We already knew that there were some people that were going to jail. and so forth. And so it's a much more fully developed investigation, crimes having been committed and so forth. So they knew a lot more at that time. And, of course, Nixon was trying to keep the tapes that he had been secretly making in his office from being revealed. And so it was much more specific. And you're right. Right now we just don't know. There's a lot of speculation, probably too much, and that's part of the problem, is that we just don't know what's going on. It lets people sort of wildly speculate. And there's, again, legitimate questions that need to be asked and answered. But when you run wild with the speculation, it kind of undercuts mm-hmm. the ability to ask those more serious questions and let the investigations, both from the FBI and the House and the Senate, play out.
We do know it's a key thing, though, Tim, do we not, that what the GOP members of GOP members of Congress, both in the House and particularly the Senate, do is key here. In this latest episode, the firing of FBI Director Comey, Democrats hoping that the sudden dismissal would move Republicans to back their claims for a special prosecutor to investigate this this Russian probe. As the dust settles a bit in the couple of days that it has, how likely does that look, that more GOP members, in addition to, well, John McCain's always been there, Lindsey Graham has always been
sure.
there, but do you see any other movement?
Jeff Flake, I think, was another one, also a senator from Arizona, along with McCain. I think he had said so as well. But on the whole, not too much along those lines. Again, part of the problem is that, for the Republicans at least, is they don't see that there's anything specific that's been revealed. And to a certain extent, that once the FBI completes this investigation, or the U.S. House or U.S. Senate, if they get to the point where they say, yes, crimes have been committed, that at that point it may be the time to appoint a special prosecutor, or if they want to call special
yeah.
counsel.
But I mean, many would say, Tim, isn't it enough that we have a sitting president who fires an FBI director, an FBI that is at that moment investigating his campaign staff? Isn't that enough of an appearance to assure the American people with a special independent prosecutor that we will get to the bottom of this?
Well, again, it's really difficult to separate the partisanship from this, because obviously Democrats tend to be the ones that are in favor of the special prosecutor, in part undoubtedly because they want to know, is there something going on here? Was there some collusion? Again, we have no evidence of this, and apparently there have been some comments that Comey made to Senators Grassley and Feinstein that there really wasn't any evidence of collusion, but people are still looking at this. And certainly the partisanship kind of goes a little further, in the sense that, well, when you have a special prosecutor, that it tends to really hurt an administration's ability to get things done, because their attention is diverted. And we've seen that when special prosecutors have been in place for both Democratic and Republican administrations. You've got what was going on with Whitewater and special prosecutor there with the Clinton administration, and of course earlier in the Nixon administration. There were things going on with the Reagan administration too, and so all this makes it very difficult. And certainly if you are of a mind to keep the Trump administration from accomplishing whatever its goals are, that special prosecutor would certainly complicate that to a certain extent. But again, until we have more information in terms of whether a specific crime, as opposed to a counterintelligence investigation, whether a specific crime of some sort was committed, then at least Republicans right now, the pressure isn't on them enough for them to say, okay, we need to have this. That yes, appearances can be bad, but it just hasn't gotten to that point for the majority of Republicans.
Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science, thanks for your input at the end of this very busy political week. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, Governor Terry Branstad's almost certain to become the next U.S. ambassador to China before our governor takes up residence in Beijing. The nation's longest-serving governor must make a stopover in Washington. He's going to attend an ambassador school and learn some of the finer points of his new job. Kyle Munson is with us, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Kyle.
Oh, hey, good morning, Ben.
Just into the afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Kyle. And you've been looking into, in a recent article, this 3-week crash course on what it means to be an ambassador in sort of practical everyday terms. What did you find out?
Yeah, I was just curious because, you know, obviously Governor Branstad has more experience as a governor than anybody, but he hasn't been a career diplomat. And, the U.S. actually has quite a number of political appointees relative to the diplomats and then the other the ambassadors we send out there into the world relative to other countries. And I started talking to, you know, people who have both been through the schooling, have taught there, talked to an associate dean, the current dean of the Leadership Institute within the Foreign Service Institute. And, you know, just to ensure that there's, a standard of, I guess, a set of knowledge for, you know, these ambassadors that get appointed and thrust into these, you know, crucial roles all around the globe, they do have a concise few weeks that they go through to, you know, just talk about foreign policy issues, to give them access to all the support and the coaching they need, to even go through media drills. You know, they're in a classroom and they pair up and they drill each other on hard questions as if they're in their role as an ambassador or diplomat and receiving questions from national or international media.
Right.
So
I just thought it was interesting in your article, Kyle, you brought out the point that one of the main differences between what Governor Branstad has been doing up to this point, he gets out to Iowa, travels around, speaks to constituents, and can speak off the cuff. Here, it's not constituents that he has in the center of his mind, is it?
No. So, you know, as the governor of a state, you answer to the voters, but you have a lot of latitude for what you say when you're out there. You're not going to, typically you're not going to cause some sort of international incident if he's in one of the 99 counties and he says something just off the cuff. But now in this role as an ambassador, he has to toe the line of a president whom we, as you've been talking this hour, can be quite unpredictable. So he has to become much more familiar with the terms. The president says this, the president says that, versus I say this or I say that. Mm. And so it's a much trickier dance.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, too, Governor Branstad's been known for traveling all around Iowa. I think he's made it clear he would like to see as much as China while U.S. ambassador to China while he's over there. But security is a big difference, isn't it?
Yeah, he travels with a state trooper wherever he goes in Iowa, and he has done the full Grassley, as it's called, the 99 county tour every year, and he has already proclaimed in the Senate confirmation hearing with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It was kind of a 2-hour love fest, but he proclaimed that he wanted to get out and explore China too, in sort of an echo of his retail politicking that he's done throughout his entire career, but. He'll be protected by U.S. Marines over there at the embassy in Beijing and wherever he travels. And, he'll have North Korea on his doorstep. It is a much, much more dangerous situation that he's in. It's not as if he's sliding quietly into retirement here as a 70-year-old seasoned politician. He is going into the toughest job of his life and any number of differences. Of course, he was a ringer for this job because of this special relationship with President Xi Jinping that we've all heard about going back decades here in Iowa, which, some ways, some people have said, maybe he can transcend his role as an ambassador, unlike others before him, in the way that he already has a much more public presence and face, almost a celebrity status amongst the Chinese. So if he really does get out there, like he says, who knows? I mean, that could make him... That could give him more of a bully pulpit for the U.S. and I guess for President Trump in a way, if he's able to do some good in that role.
Mm-hmm. We have less than a minute, Kyle, but really we can't emphasize enough this the Chinese ambassadorship, China at this point in time in U.S. geopolitics, it's near the top, if not at the top, in terms of importance to the United States, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by this story of both America and our relationship with China going back to, you were talking about Nixon recently. There's another echo of Nixon right there, Nixon going to China.
Sure.
But also these, just the Chinese civilization over centuries, and now this whole notion of the rise again of the Chinese civilization and them exerting more soft power again around the globe as our twin superpower in many ways. And, I'll be following this story actually over in China later this year. And so I'm just really fascinated by how much of this story between our two nations is funneling through Iowa.
Well, we'll follow you. Yep.
Yeah.
We'll follow your column, Kyle. We've run out of time. Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Look at his article on the 3-week crash course, what it means to be an ambassador in everyday practical terms. Kyle's looked into it. Thanks for telling us a little bit about it, Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register.
Thanks so much, Ben. Have a great weekend.
Hey, you too. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon with help from Chelsea Hoy. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.